Good morning. I'm Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. Today, I am so happy to have in the studio a good friend and industry colleague of mine, Brett Pulley, who is an accomplished journalist, entrepreneur, and author of The Billion Dollar Bet, the biography of Robert Johnson, which is the inside story of Black entertainment television, as our in-studio guest today. Brett, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
I know we've been trying to do this interview for the last couple of years because every time I turn around, you're traveling to some beautiful, exotic place to interview someone. So it's so good to have you here.
Well, I can tell you that those interviews in those places, they probably sound more exotic and more attractive and fun than they really are. But it's my pleasure to be here. I'm glad we're able to make it work.
You know, for our listening audience, share with us a little bit about your education and your background. And at some point, you're going to tell us about your nomination for Pulitzer as well.
Sure. Well, I am a graduate of Hampton University, a proud graduate, I should say, in Hampton, Virginia. I have a master's degree from Northwestern University in journalism. And in fact, I mention Hampton proudly because it's a place that I continue to spend a lot of time with. I'm also on the board of trustees at Hampton, which is just really an honor and a real pleasure. And Hampton is also the place where my wife Stacy graduated from, so it's near and dear to us.
And you started your career where? Early days, Brett.
The early
before
days.
Before Dow Jones.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm originally from Washington, and Washington area, I should say, born and raised in D.C. and went to high school in
And Oxford. He's a Redskin fan, folks. I just wanted to put that out there.
My dad bought Redskins tickets in 1963, season tickets, and God rest his soul, I still own those tickets to this day, even though I've been living here in the New York area for about 18 years. So I, of course, was quite pleased with the recent outcome of the season opener for the Giants and the Redskins, given that I'm surrounded by Giants fans and the Giants were supposed to win. But I digress.
It's been a long time since the Redskins have had something to cheer
about.
No,
the Giants have owned the Redskins for some time, so we're very happy about that. But I am from that area originally, have been here in the New York area for about 18 years. And if you and I, of course, met in Chicago, which is where we both did quality time at Dow Jones when I was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. After the Wall Street Journal moved here with the New York Times and was a national correspondent at the New York Times. After that, spent several years as a senior editor at Forbes magazine and have been at Bloomberg News the past few years. I should say in between Forbes and Bloomberg, I have covered media and entertainment for many years, which is really what I was doing most of that time at Forbes. And as a result of, you know, having spent my entire career in media while at the same time covering media, I really kind of had a front row seat as the industry began to, you know, just fundamentally shift over the past several years. And I could see from that perspective that the media industry was really on a good day going sideways at best. And while I was becoming keenly aware of that, the opportunity came along for me to go over to digital media and actually run an internet company, NewYork.com. So I did that for a couple of years, and to this day still have a stake in that company, which is a website with a great URL, newyork.com. That's very valuable in and of
itself.
Yes, and the focus is media, or is really entertainment and tourism in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for a couple of years, and for the past few years, I've been covering media and entertainment at Bloomberg News, one of the sort of fastest growing information companies out there. As you probably know, we now own Business Week magazine.
Yes.
Bought that, I guess, about a year and a half ago. And
breathe life back into it.
Yeah. The magazine looks great now, and it's really coming along. And of course, we have the core terminal business, which is what is really made Bloomberg and really built this fortune for the mayor.
Well, you and I, during our time at Dow Jones, we witnessed the start of Bloomberg and how Bloomberg had taken over the business from Telerate, which would be an interesting story to tell.
No, I tell you, that's really amazing. You're absolutely right. You know, in those days, and we're talking about the 90s, we're not talking about a real long time ago.
Talking about the 80s.
Yeah, well, the 80s, Michael Bloomberg ultimately launched
85,
yeah. his business in 1980.
Right.
And in the mid-80s, we're talking about Telerate and Dow Jones' product really being way out in front.
Right.
And, of course, now... that's non-existent and mm-hmm. was consumed by others. And while at the same time, Bloomberg has built something that has tremendous value and really is an essential tool mm-hmm. For people in financial services. And what it really amounts to is it's almost 300,000 people globally who pay a tremendous subscriber
right.
fee for all of that proprietary information that people like myself are kicking out of that place every day. And they pay over $20,000 a year, but I think it's about $22,000 or $23,000 a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you talk about a subscriber base, which is something that you know media companies are increasingly trying to find,
right.
because during this last downturn, they came to realize that they didn't want to be totally dependent on advertising. So everyone now covets the idea of having a subscriber base. That's why we see companies like the New York Times now trying to make subscribers out of their online readers.
Right.
And others are doing it. In fact, the Times just launched a paywall to build subscribers online with the Boston Globe product.
Right.
So everyone wants a subscriber base where they have that guaranteed revenue stream. And boy, Bloomberg has one that's out of this world. Given the amount those subscribers pay.
And then, of course, Bloomberg has launched into legal as well.
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, what has happened is over the last few years, Bloomberg has really sort of launched these new verticals where the idea is to become to the legal profession what we are to the financial services profession, which is an essential tool. And, you know, we've also launched Bloomberg Government in Washington, which is, again, to become to people in politics and government the same thing we are to people in financial services. The company, about 2 weeks ago, spent nearly $1 billion to buy Bureau of National Affairs, which is another... they're probably a distant cousin of Bloomberg because they're very wonkish like Bloomberg and,
right.
and very data-driven
mm-hmm.
Like Bloomberg. So all that's to build that business up in Washington.
Now, Brett, you're very humble about the success in your career, and I just like to point out that I believe that when you and I first met, we were sharing some stories, and you were telling me how when you were in graduate school that you were actually delivering the Wall Street Journal.
I was. Well, it actually was in between undergrad and graduate
okay.
school. When mm-hmm. After I finished in Hampton, I was an editorial assistant in Washington
mm-hmm.
at U.S. News and World Report.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is I was really a glorified gopher, but I had the privilege of being a glorified gopher for the editor of the magazine. And this was in the days when first Marvin Stone was the editor and then Mort Zuckerman bought the magazine and Shelby Coffey became editor. And so I worked for those guys. Harry Evans was in mm-hmm. the editor's office, Tina Brown's husband. And I um, you know, after doing that a couple of years, decided I would go back and get my master's. And before I went back to Northwestern, I needed to make money. And so I got a job delivering the Wall Street Journal. And I would do that before I, you know, before daybreak, before I went into U.S. News. And the funny part about it is, and this is where you and I connect, is that after I finished graduate school, I worked at Gannett and a couple of other papers around the country. I worked at Gannett's paper in Rochester, New York, and one out in Illinois in Danville, and USA Today, and then I went with the Tribune Company at a paper in Orlando, the Orlando Sentinel. But from there is where I landed at the Wall Street Journal in Chicago. And so they sent me to the Chicago Bureau, and there was a woman in human resources in Chicago with Dow Jones.
Nancy Ruffner.
Yes. And so the day I started, she came over and said, there's something weird in the system. I said, have you worked for the company before? And I actually didn't even realize that, I quote unquote, because because I was just delivering newspapers back then. I had no real design at that time on on being a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And Dow Jones owned a company called National Delivery Service,
right?
And that's actually who I worked for,
right?
But it was wholly owned by Dow Jones,
right?
And she said, there's something weird in the system. Your name's coming up as if you worked here before. So, I said, I did. So yes, I delivered the papers before writing for them.
But then to go from there to the New York Times, where you, I believe it was a series that you were doing on casino gambling. It was either on politics or casino gambling, but you were nominated for a Pulitzer. Tell us about that.
Well, that's an honor to have been nominated, especially at the Times. What it was, I spent probably almost 2 years writing about gambling in America.
Right.
And the idea was really to not so much write about the gaming industry, as it's called, but to really write about the social phenomena. And this was at a time when gambling was just sort of sweeping across America, from riverboat gambling to states that were actually approving casinos, to the spread of lotteries. And I don't remember the exact number, but it was something like, you know, there was some form of legalized gambling in, you know, 40-some states
right.
at that point. So we really, you know, what I really was looking at was the impact of gambling, the impact that it was having on senior citizens who were, you know, in some cases spending a lot of their time and a lot of their retirement savings in casinos, but in many cases were also finding a much-needed social outlet, to be fair, on those casino buses and with the people who they spent their time with. And, you know, and I wrote about everything from that to the impact it was having in neighboring states where the states didn't receive the tax benefit from having the casinos, but they received all the social ills in terms of people having gambling problems.
Right.
And wrote about the impact it was having on teenagers in places where going to the casino and gambling for the first time was becoming a rite of passage. So a whole host of things like that. And there was no shortage of stuff to write about at that time. And of course, I mean, it's a phenomenon that has only expanded and continues to expand, really. I mean, there are places that are still, I still hear the argument. It's funny, I was listening to something recently, like, within the last couple of weeks on television, I don't remember which state was debating the issue, but it's always the same arguments, whereas there are people who oppose it, and then typically some politicians get behind it on the basis that, to the extent there are benefits from having legalized gambling in our locality, we don't have the benefits if it's going to the state next door. So they say, and then to the extent there are any problems with it,
you know, we still have all of those, so we might as well get the upside also.
Upside, right.
That's how it ends up spreading. I mean,
right. So if we're going to get the ills, we might as well get the spills.
Absolutely.
Yes,
no, that's right. I mean, we've seen just in the last couple of years, Pennsylvania has increasingly approved the type of games that are available
City.
In the state.
It's hurting Atlantic City.
Yes. Well, you know, in Atlantic City's like another story unto itself.
It really is.
It's I think to this day still the second largest gaming location in the country, but continues to be a distant second to Las Vegas, and for, you know, a whole host of reasons seems to have a difficult time realizing its promise.
Right. Well, as I shared with you, I'm doing a series on Atlantic City, interviewing a number of folks from Atlantic City to talk about the challenges within Atlantic City. It's interesting. One of my guests said that when I asked him about crime, he said, oh, well, the crime, when you really look at the number of people that come in, crime is really not that bad. Well, I asked a pastor of the church, Pastor Days, and he said, oh, the crime is horrible. We got 27 unsolved murders. So, you know, it's interesting how you get the range of viewpoint from one person saying, oh, it's not that bad.
Sure.
But then, of course, when you got 27 unsolved murders, that is pretty bad.
And that's 27 unsolved murders really in a very small area. I mean, we're not talking about a large city.
Right. But, Brett, let's talk about your book. Fascinating book on Bob Johnson. I remember the day that the story ran in Forbes, and you stopped by my office and gave me a complimentary edition, which I have to this day.
Really? That's great.
And the story was just an awesome story. And from there, you went on to write his biography. Tell us about that experience, and tell us, what did you learn about his leadership style?
Sure. Well, the book did evolve, as you said. It evolved from a cover story at Forbes, and it's easy to know exactly how long ago it was because that cover at Forbes, we debated. That was for the Forbes 400, our annual list of the richest people in America. And Bob was, at that time, he had just become the first, by our calculation, and I think pretty much all others, the first African-American billionaire as a result of selling Black Entertainment Television to Viacom for about $3 billion. And that cover was slated to go. We were closing it when 9/11 happened. And so we debated, like every media outlet, what we would put out right after that. And we decided to go ahead and put Bob on the cover of the main issue, and then we did a special issue on the tragedy. So that was 10 years ago, and you know, and then
time flies.
It does, and and as a result of that, the opportunity came along. Agents called, etc., and the rest is history. So the book, while I had interviewed Bob on a number of occasions at the New York Times and at Forbes, once I wanted to do the book, Bob actually did not want to cooperate. So a lot of my time was spent with trying to get him to cooperate. But you know what happens in journalism in good journalism anyway, when a subject doesn't cooperate, is it inevitably forces you to dig that much deeper. And while it can be a challenge to, as we say, write around someone, it can also be very rewarding. And in the case of Black Entertainment Television, it happened to be a story that I had a lot of familiarity with from having followed and watched what he had built over the years, and from knowing people who had been there. And because remember, I'm writing about the industry that I also happen to work in and have spent my entire career in. So it was a fascinating story. And Bob really built that from nothing. I mean, he went and borrowed $500,000 ultimately. You know, he got a business plan and
sort of pulled it together and borrowed $500,000 from John Malone. And John Malone, who owns Liberty Media.
Right.
Stars, mm-hmm. Stars Television, and controls DirecTV, and a bunch of stuff. But John had made, John Malone had, at that time, really controlled a lot of cable distribution in the country. And so what cable distributors were concerned with during those days was having programming. And so they were getting behind people who had ideas for programs, and they were bankrolling new networks and taking equity in them and et cetera, which is why all of those people ended up being so tremendously rich. It was like the great gold rush at that time. And so Bob was able to launch this network that was geared towards African Americans. And, you know, and much of the programming over the years was really very inexpensive, free to very cheap. And, you know, as you know, a lot of it was music videos, which, of course, the music companies were producing, paying for and producing and handing over to channels like MTV and Black Entertainment Television because it was a way to promote their songs and
especially
sell
for
records.
The African-American artists who were not getting the type of exposure on MTV, so BET was a perfect outlet.
That's right. So MTV really created an opportunity for Bob because MTV was not playing those videos. I mean, you know, the story goes, Michael Jackson, I can't remember which one, that was kind of the first one to really, Michael Jackson was the first African-American artist to break through on MTV. MTV was really rock-oriented when it launched. So it was there was an opportunity there for Bob. So he programmed it with that kind of stuff. He programmed it with sort of lowbrow comedy, stuff that he was able to slice and dice and repurpose and, you know, show in different ways. And then, of course, also with programs that that broadcasters had aired and then canceled. So he was able to pick up these repeats of programs like, gee, I can't remember exactly which ones.
But I remember
like
that.
The Jeffersons or the Good Times and right. things that would appeal to an African-American
yes,
audience.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And, you know, he built tremendous value, really, with a low-cost product. And, you know, and they got good penetration. In part, you know, the way it works, or the way it certainly worked in those days with those cable companies was, you know, stuff would be packaged, channels are packaged together, and those distributors out there take the package. And so Bob built a tremendous distribution system, and he, you know, I don't have to tell you, you know, he was criticized a lot over the years for the type of mm-hmm. programming and the content and the racy mm-hmm. Videos. And for better or for worse, he nonetheless built a very valuable entity and was able to sell it to Viacom, which owns MTV, for about $3 billion. And, you know, John Malone, as a result of that $500 million that he invested, as I recall, I want to say his payoff was about $800 million. So he did well. And
that's off the initial $500,000?
Off of the initial, of the initial half a million.
Mm-hmm.
Got about $800 million. That was like, I think it was about 20, maybe 21 years later.
Wow.
So from a monetary standpoint, they did extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
BET continues to perform well for Viacom, and Bob Johnson, I saw him out at Sun Valley in July, is still among the media moguls.
Are you going to do a follow-up story on him?
No, I don't have any plans to. Okay. I mean, I hear different things, and there have been some different stories about, you know, he's had a couple of the investments, things that he's invested in, have not performed so well. I mean, he has significant hotels and resorts, significant investments in that area. And then, of course, he bought an NBA franchise, which I don't think performed too well. But, I mean, that's kind of the nature of that business. And he sold it to Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan, yes. Mm-hmm.
So he got out of that business.
Right.
He didn't waste too much time with that. But I would certainly write about him if something that he did rose to the
right,
occasion.
Right.
But I don't have any mm-hmm. specific plans to.
Mm-hmm. You've interviewed Sumner Redstone, you've interviewed Eisner, Bob Johnson, and a host of other people. Do you feel comfortable to say who you felt was the most dynamic leader?
And I tell you, that's always it's always such a tough question because you talk to so many people.
Right.
It's always difficult to say, like, who's the most impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tomorrow, for example, I'm talking to tomorrow morning, and not to drop names, but in the morning I'm having breakfast with Jean-Bernard Levy, who's the CEO of Vivendi.
Right.
Which, you know, owned Universal and still owns Universal
right.
Music
mm-hmm.
And a bunch of telecom
mm-hmm.
And cable businesses
right.
In France and
mm-hmm.
South America.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think different CEOs are impressive at different times. You know, certainly the one who made the most, who I would say is the most impressive CEO who I've talked to, and I'll tell you about the nature of our conversation, is, you know, I think without a doubt, Steve Jobs. I mean, I don't even have to explain, probably.
Yeah, phenomenal, just phenomenal.
You know, yeah, I mean, to have the kind of vision, and, you know, what I see from Steve Jobs, and this doesn't come from my conversation with him, but what I see, and I've paid attention for a long time, I mean, going back before he left Apple, was forced
mm-hmm.
out the first time,
mm-hmm.
is there is this absolute fearless approach, and I think that's one of the qualities
mm-hmm.
that really comes through with
mm-hmm.
the best leaders and the most impressive leaders of people who are not afraid to fail. I mean, Steve Jobs basically failed the first time at Apple
mm-hmm.
and came back when the place was on life support.
Oh, right, right.
I mean, really, they were three months away from bankruptcy.
That's right. Microsoft had to give him a loan.
Yeah, and he turned it into, you know, arguably the most phenomenal company of our time.
Well, there was a statistic I heard recently that Apple has more money than the U.S. government.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I mean, they surpassed who's it? Exxon.
Yeah.
As right
mm-hmm.
as the largest company. I mean, it's an amazing company, and one that is so built on one man's
mm-hmm.
vision and sort of pursuit of perfection.
Yes.
With products.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Just
but
phenomenal.
But my conversation with Steve was not because I was interviewing Steve. My conversation with Steve was because I was doing a cover story on Michael Eisner.
Okay.
Who also was a pretty good CEO. He
right.
had a unceremonious departure at
mm-hmm. That's right.
at Disney, but was a great CEO
mm-hmm.
During his time and built tremendous
mm-hmm.
value there. So I actually went out to a World Series game with Michael Eisner.
Mm-hmm.
This was when Disney owned the Anaheim team, and we went into the booth, and it was sort of star-studded. So I go down and sit next to this guy and his son.